Of course, there was a time when the subject of sex was shut out of the public arena altogether in this country. It was one of those things you just didn't talk about, not in public anywhere. The cinema could explore passionate love affairs if it wanted to, but the director always cut to another camera when the couple got to the bedroom door, didn't he? Nowadays, the pendulum's rather swung to the opposite extreme. Our culture is close to being obsessed with sex. Erotic images assail us from all directions, from TV advertisements, pop songs, video shops, magazine stands. The subtle titillation of the post-war romantic novel has been replaced by the rather more crude explicitness of the 1980s sex manual, like The Joy of Sex, that no doubt many of you have seen on bookstands, even if you don't have a copy of your own. Only in the church, it seems, does the old inhibition about sex remain. Only in the pulpit is it still a forbidden subject. Only, it seems, among Christians does Victorian shockability about this area still survive. Well, over the next two Sunday nights, we're going to storm this final citadel of prudery. Not, I hasten to add, in order to ape the world's preoccupation with the subject of sex. No, we're going to talk about sex tonight and next Sunday night because the Bible does talk about it. More explicitly and with less inhibition than many books that you could find quaintly labelled health or something else in W.H. Smith's. It's all in one of the most remarkable and controversial books we find within the pages of the Bible, the Song of Solomon. Or to give it its full name, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. That's the Hebrew title that you find at the beginning of the very first verse of chapter 1. The phrase Song of Songs isn't difficult to understand. In Hebrew, that's simply a superlative, like King of Kings or Holy of Holies. Song of Songs just means the best song of all. But the reference to Solomon is rather more difficult to interpret. Does it mean that Solomon was the author of this song? It could do. 1 Kings 4 ascribes 1,005 songs to Solomon's pen, so this could very easily be one of them. Or does it mean Solomon discovered this song and gave it wide public circulation, because almost certainly he was a compiler of works of literature as well as an author? Or does it mean it was dedicated to Solomon, perhaps a specially composed piece written by the poet laureate in order to celebrate one of his many royal weddings? Or could it even be that Solomon is actually intended to be the hero of this poem? Is he to be identified with one of the characters the book portrays? Well, a definite answer to that question is impossible. To some extent, it depends on a much wider question of interpretation that we have to examine a little before we get down to actually look at the book in detail. And that question is there a storyline in the Song of Solomon? Unfortunately, opinions differ on this question, and it makes it very difficult to interpret the book in a way that everybody will feel happy with. At one extreme, there are folk who see the book simply as a collection of love poems, with no unifying thread to hold the poems together at all, just a compilation. At the other extreme, though, there are commentators who see a very complex drama underlying the text of the Song of Solomon. The moving story of how a beautiful girl from the northern hills of Israel fell in love with a local shepherd boy, but who was then rather unwittingly taken to join his royal harem by the lecherous King Solomon. Well, for myself, I have to say right at the beginning, I find it unacceptable to take either of those extreme positions. There is quite clearly, to my mind, a very carefully arranged structure in this book involving some degree of narrative development, and we'll look at that in just a moment. But on the other hand, the so-called shepherd hypothesis, this eternal triangle motif of the young man falling in love with the young girl and then his bride being stolen by the king, that really does involve far too much speculative reading into the text for my taste. You have to do quite a lot of imagining to get that story out of the book. It certainly doesn't stand out to you. And in fact, it seems to me too rather intrinsically improbable that this book would ever have come down to us as Solomon's Song of Songs if he was in fact the villain of the piece, which that particular theory requires him to be. So I want to suggest to you a mediating position tonight and next Sunday, based on a couple of observations which I think are reasonably undeniable when you just look at the text as it is presented to us. The first observation I'll make about this song generally is that there seem to me to be only two distinguishable main characters. And if you've got the NIV version of the Bible, they are helpfully distilled out for you. There's a male character, whom the NIV calls the lover, and there's a female character, whom the NIV calls the beloved. And this isn't just guesswork on the part of the NIV, in general terms, for the words of these two characters can be disentangled in the original Hebrew on the basis of the gender of the pronouns, Hebrew distinguishing male and female pronouns quite carefully. The only other clearly distinguishable contribution, it seems to me, comes from a group of bystanders who every now and again interject some contribution, some refrain, rather like the chorus in a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. And the NIV designates the words of these, which of course occur in the plural in the Hebrew text, the friends. Now, it seems in view of this sort of simple analysis of the text, far less contrived to regard the book as a simple romance, then, with no invasive third party threatening the relationship. It's the story of a boy and a girl falling in love and getting married. At least, that's how I understand it. The second observation I'll make is that if you look at the text with care, I think you can distinguish that it's actually seven poems arranged around a central climax. Now, the word climax here may carry a rather risque, but not altogether inappropriate, double entendre. Because if you count the number of poetic lines in this book and divide by two, you find the precise centre of the book lies at the stanza, which is at the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5. The section which I've labelled on my outline here, consummation. Let me read them to you. 4 verse 16 is the beginning of this central couplet. Awake, north wind, and come, south wind, blow on my garden, that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. Then the lover replies, I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. And then the friends, the third group who contribute to this drama, sing in chorus, eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers. Now, reading that superficially, you may feel this is a rather odd exchange between two people regarding their common interest in horticulture. I'm afraid if that's your impression, you're in for a shock. In fact, it's a shock which you will constantly have if you read the Book of Solomon, the Song of Solomon, with open eyes. There is a great deal of talk in the Song of Solomon about gardens and vineyards, flowers and fruits, honey and wine, perfumes and spices. But there is no question at all that this vocabulary is always laden with erotic overtones. Now, I'm not saying that such words are altogether without literal significance, because these lovers certainly do seem to have spent a lot of time together in rural settings. But there can be no doubt, I think, that this language that we have an example of here at this central stanza, for instance, about the lover coming into his garden, is euphemistic. It's the way in which the poet handles extremely intimate sexual themes. And in the case of 4:16 to 5:1, I've no doubt in my mind that what we have here is a description of the physical consummation of the lover's relationship. Let my love come into his garden to taste its choice fruits. Here's the excited invitation of the newlywed bride on the first night of the honeymoon. I have come into my garden, my bride. I have drunk my wine and my milk. Here is the satisfied testimony of the newlywed husband the morning after. That's what we've got there. If you read the Song of Solomon without catching these sexual innuendos, you really won't understand what the poet is talking about. It's precisely those sexual innuendos, of course, which have made the book so controversial over the years. This kind of poetic language, of course, isn't completely foreign to us. If you were to be told that a young couple in love went into the woods to learn about the birds and bees, you wouldn't conclude that they'd gone to study natural history, would you? In the same way, a Hebrew reader
reading these words, would not conclude that they'd gone to study asters and dahlias and chrysanthemums. Arranged around this central stanza, then, describing the consummation of the lover's relationship, are six other poems. You can often tell in the text where these poems end by the refrain that concludes them. For instance, one refrain that occurs three times in the song, which marks out the end point of these separate poems, is, "Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires." You'll find that at 2 verse 7, at the end of the first poem. "Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires." And then again at 3 verse 5, at the end of the second poem, "Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires." Then, of course, middle section marks off the break in the middle. And then you'll find that same rephrase occurs again at 8 verse 4, marking off the last two poems, "Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires." And that leaves only the two poems of the second half, the ones I've called "A Lover's Tiff" and "Making It Up Again," as a little bit difficult to be sure where one poem ends and another begins. But I'm fairly confident that 6 verse 3 is the actual point we're intended to note. This kind of arrangement around a central climax, very common in Hebrew poetry. Often, Hebrews put the center of gravity of their literary works in the middle rather than at the end. There are many examples of that, and this is just one of them. So I say, arranged around this central stanza, we have these six other poems, and each pursues a different theme, demonstrating, in my view, a rather simple chronological development rather than what you could call a real plot. There is first a date, there's spring romance, then there's the wedding, and then, and we've already noticed, there's the consummation and honeymoon, and then after that, there's a lover's tiff, which they make up, and finally, the stable contentment of married bliss. And this is the structure we're going to follow for these two studies. Tonight, we're going to survey the first half, from first date up to wedding night, and then next Sunday evening, I hope you'll be back, we should look at the second movement, from lover's tiff to married bliss. You may conclude that tonight is specially appropriate to engaged couples, and next Sunday will be particularly appropriate to those of us who are married. Well, it may not be quite as simple as that. We haven't, of course, got time for a detailed exposition of the text, but then in a way this is not the sort of Bible passage which really warrants intensive cerebral analysis. This is a love poem designed first and foremost to touch our hearts, not to teach us doctrine. So it's far better, really, to respond to it as you would to poetry. One commentator even suggests it's better performed as a kind of oratorio rather than preached, and I think he may well be right about that. So what we're going to do is scan these first five chapters tonight with the goal of just emotionally engaging with the poem rather than understanding every allusion that the author makes. Let's begin with first date. Here's a young girl, then, who has noticed a very good-looking young man among the shepherds and is dreaming romantic dreams, as young girls sometimes do. "Oh, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth," she's thinking to herself. Of course, this particular young man is rather popular with the girls. He's so good-looking, and she can't blame them for fancying him. But she longs to be the one woman of his life, she his queen, he, her king. As she weighs up her chances, she's rather tormented by feelings of self-doubt about her appearance. Often happens when you want very much to be attractive to somebody, doesn't it? Look at verse 5 and 6. "How right they are to adore you," that is the other maidens. "Dark am I, yet lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, dark like the tents of Kedar, like the tent curtains of Solomon. Do not stare at me because I'm dark, because I'm darkened by the sun. My mother's sons were angry with me and made me take care of the vineyards. And my own vineyard I have neglected." In other words, she seems to have been rather a Cinderella in the family, disliked by her older brothers and forced to work in the vineyards, with the result that her complexion has suffered. Of course, that would be a pain for any young woman, wouldn't it? Though it's odd, isn't it, how we're never satisfied with the skin we've got. European girls tend to spend a lot of time under UV lights trying to get a tan. Whereas African girls, I know, spend a great deal of money on chemical lotions in a vain attempt to lighten their skin. We're never satisfied with the colour of skin we've got. This girl, like many African girls, wished she was fairer. But she's not so lacking in self-esteem that she's unaware of her positive features too. Dark I am, she says, yet lovely, and so she has sufficient confidence of her own attractiveness to make the first move in this relationship, or at least so it seems in verse 7. Tell me, you whom I love, bold young thing, where you graze your flock, and where you rest your sheep at midday. Why should I be like a veiled woman beside the flocks of your friends? In other words, let's meet somewhere where we can be alone, talking to you with all these other shepherd lads around, making their crude comments make me feel just like a prostitute. That's the reference here to a veiled woman. Now, the young man, who had obviously noticed her charms and is by no means antagonistic to her advances, replies, she really shouldn't blame the other men for their lecherous glances. Putting a beautiful girl like this in a male-dominated shepherd's camp is a bit like letting loose a mare among the stallions of the Egyptian cavalry, he says. It's going to provoke sexual excitement. Well, eventually, as you see as you cast your eye down the poem, they do find their sequestered rendezvous in the forest. Look, says the lover, we've got our own private palace here in the woods, 117. The beams of our house are cedars, our rafters are firs. Yes, replies the girl, in modest self-deprecation, I am like an insignificant little flower, poking its head up through the undergrowth. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. Nonsense, says the boy, there's nothing insignificant about you. Like a lily among the thorns is my darling among the maidens. In other words, you're the most attractive girl in the neighbourhood, and don't you forget it. And the girl replies, taking her cue from his flattery, yes, and like an apple tree among the trees of the forest is my lover among the young men. In other words, you're not such a bad hunk yourself, and I fancy eating you. And so this first poem closes with a picture of the two wrapped in one another's arms in their woodland retreat, physically drained from the discovery of their passion. Strengthen me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am faint with love. His left arm is under my head, and his right arm embraces me. I think you'll agree it's a pretty successful first date. So we come to our second poem, The Spring Romance, beginning at 2 verse 8. Listen, my lover, look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. This poem seems to suggest that the shepherd had had to leave the area for a while. Well, shepherds in the ancient world often had to do this during the winter months to seek grazing. That may very well be the reason. But the spring has returned. And, well, you know what they say about spring and a young man's fancy. Once he's back in town, he looks her up. Verse 10 or verse 9. My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing through the windows, peering through the lattice. Is she still around, that girl I went out with last November? My lover spoke and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, and come with me. See, the winter is past, the rains are over and gone, flowers appear on the earth, the season of singing has come, the cooing of doves is heard in our land, and so on and so on. In other words, all nature is pairing off. It's spring. Life is bursting with fertility. Let's join in the fun. So in verses 14 and 15, we have what seems to be to me a little cameo of their lovers' games that they played. Hide and seek in 2:14. My dove is in the cleft of the rocks, in the hiding places on the mountainside. Show me your face. Let me hear your voice. You must have seen boys and girls playing this sort of silly game. And as for verse 15, a difficult verse, commentators argue about it. But I suspect, again, it's a reference to a lover's game, perhaps a game of catch me if you can. Catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards. Our vineyards are in bloom. And then 2 verse 16 begins what seems to be a dream sequence. I think we're to imagine the girl returning to her bed that night after a deliriously happy day with her lover. And not unnaturally, she finds herself fantasizing that he's in bed with her. Images of browsing among the lilies, in verse 16, and being like a young stag on the rugged hills in verse 17, are pretty transparent euphemisms for the sexual desire that this young man has awoken in her. But then suddenly the dream turns to a nightmare, as lovers' fantasies sometimes do. She discovers tristesse. In her dream, he suddenly disappeared. She can't find him. In blind panic, we find at the beginning of chapter 3, she makes her way out into the street in a vain search for him. I will get up now and go about the city, through its streets and squares. I'll search for the one my heart loves. I looked for him, but I couldn't find him. The watchmen find me, and they make their as they make their rounds in the city. Have you seen the one my heart loves? She asks. But then suddenly, she sees him again. Her relief knows no bounds. There's no way I'm going to let this man out of my sight like that again, she says to herself. I'd have pined away if I'd lost him. No, I'm taking this fellow straight back to my parents before he goes off again. 3 verse 4. Scarcely had I passed them when I found the one my heart loves. I held him and would not let him go till I'd brought him to my mother's house, to the room of the one who conceived me. See, this is a very advanced young lady. Very 20th century young lady. This is the man I want to marry, mother. Get the bottom drawer open. That's what this verse is saying. And marry him she does. So we come to our third poem in this triad leading up to the central climax. The wedding. 3 verse 6. Who is this coming up from the desert like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant? Look, it's Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. Verse 11, come out, you daughters of Zion, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. Now, these verses are really the crunch issue as far as sorting out the storyline is concerned. Those who subscribe to the eternal triangle theory see this as King Solomon arriving in state with an armed escort to snatch away this girl from her beloved fiancé. For those who, like me, find that construction rather unconvincing, there are two alternative explanations. One is that the king's name is used here purely figuratively. It would not, you see, be out of keeping with the poetic mood of this song if we found the young bride fantasizing that her wedding procession, the wedding procession of her young groom, coming up to collect her from her house, to escort her to the place of the wedding, that this wedding procession was actually a magnificent royal pageant belonging to that most notorious of all Don Juans of the ancient world, King Solomon, nonetheless. Alternatively, it's not impossible that Solomon himself is intended to be the lover in this poem. Now, I know it's hard to imagine Solomon as a rural shepherd lad, but some commentators speculate, on the basis of a verse you'll find in chapter 8 verse 11, that Solomon, as a young king, actually purchased a farm in the far north of Israel as a kind of summer retreat. And while he was on holiday there, early in his reign, he'd fallen in love with this dark-skinned gypsy, and that now, in chapter 3, he's returning in full regalia to claim her as his bride. Well, that may be true. But either way, there is no need, in my view, to ascribe the intensely erotic poetry that follows in chapter 4 in the mouth of the lover to some lecherous villain who has intruded into the story. No, chapter 4, I'm quite sure, is the words of the same lover as we've met in earlier chapters. Only this time, it's his wedding night. And in chapter 4, he's telling his new bride what a stunningly sexy creature she is. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. It's true the metaphors which he uses are not always particularly flattering to our modern ear. In verse 1, he tells her that her hair falls from her shoulders like a flock of goats coming down the mountainside. In verse 2, he tells her that her teeth look like newly dipped lambs coming out of the sheep dip. And in verse 4, he tells her neck resembles a military fortification hung with armor plating. It's difficult to imagine that particular line working very well in the back row of the Odeon in the 1990s, isn't it? But then metaphors are a funny thing, aren't they? I can never work out why the French think it's romantic to talk about somebody as a little cabbage. Nor can I understand why American girls should feel flattered at being thought of as somebody's baby. Metaphors are funny. Clearly in Israel 3,000 years ago, to compare your beloved to a farmyard animal or a public monument was definitely a turn-on. Why shouldn't it be? And that this young couple are turned on, there is no doubt. They've dated one another. They've wooed one another. Now they've married one another. Now the best moment of all, 3 verse 12. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Once you've got used to the euphemistic language of the Song of Solomon, it's quite clear that that's a reference to the virginity of this young girl. They've had a passionate courtship, but there's been no premarital intercourse to render the honeymoon an anticlimax. So the poem reaches its summit. The love affair reaches its consummation. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. And he does. Well, it is, I think you'll agree, a very moving poem. If it were portrayed visually, I'm quite sure it would have got an 18 certificate. And that being so, it's not surprising, is it, that both Jews and Christians have had problems with this book. How can a volume of erotic love poems possibly have any place in the canon of Holy Scripture? For a start, the name of God is never mentioned from one end of this book to the other. So how can it be in the Bible? What possible spiritual value can such a work have? Now, one solution to that problem, as David hinted earlier, is to interpret the book allegorically. An allegory is a story in which there's an intended hidden meaning underlying the surface words. Pilgrim's Progress is an example of an allegory that most of us are probably familiar with. You know, the burden on Pilgrim's back symbolizes his sin. The key in his hand symbolizes God's promise. The journey he takes symbolizes the Christian life, and so on. According to the allegorical interpretation of the Song of Solomon, what we have here is a symbolic representation of divine love, the love of God for Israel, if we're Jews, the love of Christ for the church, if we're Christians. In the King James translation of the Bible, the Authorized Version, this interpretation was more or less canonized by the explanatory subheadings which were given. And that's why in the Puritan era you found so many English divines in their commentaries on the Song of Solomon just assuming an allegorical interpretation, and why many of our hymns from that period reflect that same interpretive scheme. But I have to tell you, frankly, I find such an allegorical view very unsatisfying. Indeed, potentially it leads to some very embarrassing speculations. I mean, Cyril of Alexandria, one of the ancient early church fathers, looking at 1 verse 13, my lover is to me a sachet of myrrh resting between my breasts, says, well, you know what that means, of course. The two breasts are the Old and New Testaments, and the sachet of myrrh is Jesus, who unites them. Well, you know, I suppose he could see it. It also leads to some pretty crass mistakes. You've probably heard Christians sometimes talk about Jesus as the Rose of Sharon and the Lily of the Valley. We even find it in some of our choruses. It's the most inappropriate use of the book of Song of Solomon, because if you look at the text, you'll find those words actually occur in the mouth of the beloved, of the girl, describing herself. She's saying, as I was said earlier, I'm an insignificant little flower, a little crocus on the valley floor, a little lily of the valley that hardly is noticed. And the lover's saying, not at all, my dear. You're a magnificent lily that makes everything else around you look like a bunch of thorns. That's the meaning of the poem. So it can lead to all kinds of inappropriate use of the Song of Solomon language too, this allegorical mode of interpretation. It's been generated, of course, mainly because Christians have not understood that sexuality is something positive and good in the Bible, given to men and women in their innocence in the Garden of Eden. Too much of maybe the Greek idea of the body as something essentially evil, and the spirit as something essentially incorporeal, something not related to the flesh, has stolen into Christian thinking over the years, so that we can no longer understand this very Hebrew sentiment. I want to suggest to you that, properly understood, the Song of Solomon teaches us at least four things. First, it's an affirmation of physical love. Here is God's imprimatur on the joy of sex, if you like. Nothing could be further from the mind of God than the super spirituality that suggests there is something superior about lifelong celibacy. That isn't so. On the contrary, according to the book of Genesis, God made man and woman for sexual union. The two shall be one flesh. And the Song of Solomon, at its simplest, is simply an ecstatic celebration of that one flesh relationship which a man and a woman may share in God's creation plan. It's a marvelous affirmation of physical love as something beautiful and good in God's plan. The second thing which it is an apologia for monogamous fidelity. We don't have to subscribe to the eternal triangle theory of the Song of Solomon to see in it a critique of Solomon's later polygamous ways. These two lovers, you see, are completely happy in one another. They don't need any other sexual partner for their satisfaction. The very idea would mar their joy. It's a celebration, again, of the fact that you only need one person, one sexual partner, to fully satisfy you. That's the Bible's conviction. And in our day and age, it's one we need to reaffirm very strongly. The third thing which the Song of Solomon is an exhortation to sexual patience. Do you notice, again, that chorus which I pointed out to you, which often brings the verse to an end? The fact that it's repeated highlights it, and makes us realize that the author really wants us to take note of these words. You could almost say this is the point he's trying to make. What is it again? Do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. In other words, don't inflame Eros prematurely. Don't be in too much of a hurry to get into physical, sexual engagement with another person. Take your time about it. It's too good to prostitute on anybody but the right person. It's too intoxicating to indulge in anything but at the right time. As I say, the love affair of this young couple was intensely passionate. And yet it's clear from the lover's words in 4:12 that she was still a virgin on their marriage night. I'm sure the author intends us to note that. Not until that night can the chorus, these friends, relax the patience that they have been sworn to exercise in earlier verses, and at last encourage the husband and wife to find total sexual fulfillment in one another. Eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers. Now's the moment. You've been patient a long while. Now's the moment. We'll come back to that next week. And finally, what we have here in the Song of Solomon, I suggest to you, is a picture of divine love. No, not an allegory. This song's intended to be read at face value as the little story of a real love affair. I've got no doubt about that. But that doesn't mean that there is no spiritual significance, in spite of the fact the word God isn't mentioned. For you see, according to the Apostle Paul in the New Testament, there is a spiritual significance in every love affair. This is an idealized love affair, a perfect love affair, if you like. Paul says that all love affairs reflect the love of Christ for the church. He even goes so far as to say that that verse in the book of Genesis about the two being one flesh has this extra meaning to it for a Christian. It is a mystery which speaks of the union between Christ and the church. So not just this marriage, but every marriage sets forth the mystery of the divine love. And in that sense, the Puritans and others who use the vocabulary of the Song of Solomon to describe their devotion to Christ and Christ's devotion to them were not wrong. They may have gone over the top sometimes through their allegorizing. But in principle, they're not wrong to use this romantic, even erotic language of the relationship between Christ and the believer. But perhaps the most amazing thing about Christianity is that it's not just about how we feel about Jesus. Christianity is about how he feels towards us. He feels like a lover, like a husband. He loves us with all the passion and commitment of a perfect spouse. And he wants us with all the desire and possessiveness of a perfect spouse. So you see, every act of sexual consummation between a man and a woman who give themselves to one another in marriage in purity and fidelity, every such act is God's picture of the spiritual consummation which will one day unite Christ and the Christian. There's nothing dirty about the joy of sex. Rightly understood, it is a foretaste of the joy of heaven. Come back next week and we'll say a bit more about that. Let's pray together.